everything, figure out what the hell's going on. What is going on now? What's the latest news?
They're about to vote right now on the speaker. So I don't know what's going to happen there. Jim Jordan and Mr. What's his name?
Austin Scott.
Austin Scott. That's
one of the two Scotts from Georgia. This is the one Austin.
Jim Jordan and one of the Scotts. Yeah. Is being elected right now. They're going through the nominations. You think Jim Jordan gets it?
I think he gets a nomination here in the conference.
Yeah.
I think he does. I think he gets there. Look, McCarthy's backing him. Sean Hannity's backing them. I think he's got the nomination. I don't know what the hell happens on the floor. I mean, my thing is that, like, if there's plenty of people who hate Jim Jordan, probably just as many people as hate Scalise, if not more, right? So the question is not, are there enough people to bring him down? The question is, are those people willing to act on the floor? Yeah. And I think they might not be able to. And if I'm Jordan, I'd say, screw it. I'm going to the floor. I'm going to dare those people to vote against me. And they might not. They might fall in line. They got a lot of reasons to fall in line. And they're the type of people who do fall in line.
It is the type of people who do fall in line. All those moderates who would be like, this is the worst idea for me ever, are probably going to be like, I don't want to like incur the wrath of the conservative right, having vote against him, keep the shenanigans, the sort of like this week that's going insane, keep it going. They might just want to end it and like move on and then announce a retirement in like a couple weeks.
On your hand, you got like the other faction that might be pissed as hell, which is like the Mike Rogers types, armed services types, who just do not want this guy in that seat because they're really worried about stuff like the Ukraine aid, right?
Yep. Yeah, I mean, I think, and that's one of the things, maybe like the biggest thing about what's just happened with McCarthy. It's not like the CR. It's not the spending stuff. It's not just, it's like the immediate short-term, like foreign relations type stuff that's really present. Like Ukraine aid is on the chopping block because of this decision. And that's functionally like really the biggest difference between whoever comes after McCarthy and McCarthy, right? I don't know that, like, I don't see much different. I mean, because, like, this is the weird part about us. We deposed a speaker for the first time in House history, and functionally nothing's changed, right? In a lot of ways. I mean, we don't have a speaker, but, like, House politics are still the same. There's still no working majority in the House. And I think that's, like, the big thing. Like, the motion to vacate was not used in a way that it was intended to be used, which is when a majority no longer is a majority and there's a new majority there to unseat the speaker and put in a new leader because a new faction, new coalition, new alliance has emerged, right? That's the whole intent of the motion to vacate. It's like, we've lost the majority. Somebody else has it. Let them put a speaker in place. But here, this has just been used as a personnel tool where it's just like, hey, we're just going to take the head off a guy and then we're going to move on. And moving on means that, like, we're going to go back to the status quo, which is we don't have a working majority, still can't get spending bills on the floor, and there's no real clarity on what's going to happen with CR or anything else in the near future.
Yeah, and you've kind of gone backwards as a party because, you know, McCarthy got 96% of the GOP vote
in the
resolution to vacate the chair, and then Scalise gets like 51%, and now we're trying Jordan, who first time around on a vote got 47%, right? We're just going the wrong direction in terms of unifying the party, and none of the moves they're making are party unifying moves. It's all people trying to just one time, one vote, grab the reins, and I don't think that's how you're going to get to a stable settlement. There needs to be a coalition that comes together that believes in someone, at least in a compromise sense. And wearing people down through exhaustion and desperation can work, but I don't know where it gets you a month from now. Like November 17th is looming.
Right.
And like so Jordan wins and the moderates don't have the stomach to take him out on the floor. I could totally see it now at this point. I can't believe I'm saying that, but I could see it. And what does Jordan do on November 17th, right? Does he find a way to smoothly sell out to a CR compromise and some funding? Maybe. I don't really imagine that. Does he go become shutdown king? Maybe. Or do like he make like a sellout move that because he has to because he's the leader and then he just acts the same way. Matt Gaetz is back on the warpath. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I know. And that's the weird thing about this is like I don't see evidence of negotiations between like various groups. It just seems like we've got a veto. We've got this other group has a veto and they're just sitting there staring at one another, like as if somebody's going to make a move that changes the status quo. It's like, you know, these normally these things kind of go the way Nancy Pelosi went. Like, she's like, I've got a big bunch of votes, right? I'm short about 40. What am I going to do? I'm going to go and I'm going to give something to these people. I'm going to give something to these people. I'm going to give something to these people. And you buy up votes, you barter, you compromise, you make promises that like other people don't like, but that's part of the deal of like being elected speaker. And then you kind of get everybody be like, all right, we're going to the floor. Everybody together, everybody's together. All right, let's vote for the thing. And it's weird because we were just talking about this in the office the other day. You know, Fitzpatrick and Roy come together. They create this like process, right? It's like, what we're going to do is we're going to talk about it for a little bit. We're going to vote. And then we're going to have another one. And the person that doesn't like it, you know, is at the lowest vote, they're going to drop. And then we're going to have another round of discussion. And then we're going to vote again. And we'll just keep doing that until we get to 217. It's like, that's a normal process, right? Why would you need to amend the rules of the Republican Party just to put in place like a normal negotiation? I thought that was fascinating because it doesn't seem like they're doing the normal sort of negotiating that you would find for a speaker election.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, it's the substitution sort of procedure for politics in some ways in that sense, right? Like all they're doing is the procedural motions. And you would think you'd be going around and people are making calls, right? But they don't seem to be the right calls. They seem to be calls of like, will you back me in this vote, when they need to be calls of how are we going to settle this? And part of it is that like there just may not be a stable 217 right now,
yep,
for anyone in the Republican Party. And look, I really think it's asymmetric. Again, not just the floor votes, but I think the moderates would be willing to sort of compromise. I just think there's too much incentive on the right side of the ledger right now in the Republican Party, where like not compromising is great because then you get to have your sort of sellout swamp creature angle against the establishment, against whoever wins, right? And it'll just be one more thing. If Jordan gets brought down on the floor, like that's great for the right, right? It's like, oh, look what these crazy establishment people do. They won't even let us have the leadership, right? They failed and now they're blocking us, right? And so like they almost win when you fail. And I'm not sure how to handle that right now as a party. Do you think the Democrats are going to stay on the sidelines indefinitely here, or do you think they are going to actually start making plays?
Well, it would be in their interest to make some plays, right? They would reaching out, trying to find like any sort of agreement, compromise, something that would put somebody that is more in line with their views in place. I just don't think that's possible right now, though. Yeah. I mean, based on how they treated the motion to vacate vote, I don't know that like really reaching across the aisle is like a viable solution right now or a viable alternative, because you know they had the chance to reach across the aisle and save McCarthy, maybe by some goodwill for, you know, a deal, whether that was a CR or whether that was a spending deal or something along those lines, and they chose not to. And like part of it was like, you know, well, he needs to come to us. It's like, well, part of it's not, you know, you could have gone to him or you could have chosen a different path. And you know, there was no goodwill between Democrats and McCarthy, and I mean there's going to be no goodwill between Republicans and Democrats. And so yeah, like theoretically, yeah, they should like not stay on the sideline, but like I don't see a venue through which like Republicans will, one, want them to be involved, and two, the angle in which they really sell that group of Republicans, it just doesn't seem like it's in the cards at the moment.
Yeah, I agree. You know, you see this sometimes in the state legislature level where you have sort of, it's variously described as coups or power grabs or things like that, where the minority party is able to tempt away a handful of people to create a new majority coalition. And often the people who get tempted away get huge prizes, right? Like, If Don Bacon got four friends and went to the Democrats and said, I'm going to be speaker and these four people are going to be the chairs of Ways and Means, Probes, Financial Services, and Energy and Commerce, like the Dems might go for it, right? Like,
yeah,
it's not like crazy to think that doesn't happen, but they just haven't happened in Congress historically. It's something you see at the state legislature level. You don't see it in Congress. And I think the insane scenario is, in my mind, is the Democrats bailing out a Republican speaker. I could imagine the coalition where a handful of Republican moderates essentially decide to party switch, right? And build a new majority that they are sitting on top of. And that's sort of the state legislature model. You don't see a whole lot of like minority party to the rescue of the existing establishment structure.
Right.
But I also think like right now the Democrats are taking essentially what is a pretty safe line, which is we're in the minority in the House. We'd like to be in the majority in the House next time around. And so anything that we do passively that makes this more of a crash and burn is like good for us. Yeah. That may not be satisfying sort of normatively or ethically, like as a, you know, politics, but I think it's certainly strategically not insane for them to be acting the way they're acting. It kind of makes rational sense.
It does. I mean, one of the things though is like, and despite all like the, you know, kind of partisanship and like this is normal for legislative parties or whatever, it's like it's kind of not too. I mean, like, you know, if anything, like the norm for Democrats this past go around would have been just sort of like stand to the side. I mean, like they were put in an unprecedented position. There's no question about that. Like, how are you going to vote on the speaker? Like, that's not something that any party has been asked to vote on in 100 years. And so they were put in a very unusual position. But like closer to the norm would have been like, we're just staying out of this. Like, we're just hands off. We're not going to get involved.
Yeah, but I don't really like, I agree with you, like that's sort of the norm, but like you're forced to the vote, right? Like no matter what they do, yes, no, present or walk out of the chamber, like you are making a choice there that has a consequence. And I mean, that's always true sort of in politics, but like it seems to me that based on how the chamber understands it, we'd be better off generally with a system where the way you vacated the chair was by signing a discharge petition that got like immediate expedited consideration as soon as it got to 217 or 218, right? Because the minority doesn't feel sort of obligated to sign on to discharge petitions, right? So you'd have those eight losers, anti-McCarthy losers, I said it, right? Signing on to the petition. And then Democrats would just look at it and laugh and shrug their shoulders. And like you would only ever get that sort of vacate when you had a true new majority, like you were talking about. Once you force people to vote in the chambers, like the Democrats can vote yes, they can vote no, they can vote present, and all of those are them ultimately choosing what happens to McCarthy.
Yeah, I think it was they were put in a really difficult spot. And I get why they did that. It's sort of like normal within the partisan norms of what's happening today. But yeah, it definitely like it has ramifications now, obviously, right? And the strategic choice here is like, you know, you booted McCarthy and now you have possibly Speaker Jordan coming up in the wings, right? Was that a decision that served you? And I don't know. I can't really say like they don't know what's going to play out on that, but like at the same time, it seems like strategically it was something that, I mean, maybe they're enjoying the sort of chaos of today, but like I don't know that there's a real angle. I don't think this is something that plays in 2024. Like, oh, they booted McCarthy. And so, you know, I don't think there's an electoral angle. I think those arguments are pretty much overwrought. It just seems like they were put in a tough spot and made a decision that makes sense in today's context. But outside of that, I don't know that it made much more sense than that.
Yeah. I'm just going to break in here with completely tangent is that I'm watching Twitter right now, and literally just now, George Santos is going on an absolute like expletive-laden tirade in the hallway in Longworth with all the reporters following, screaming at some guy who's arguing with him about Israel policy. So that's happening too as we speak. Live video of Santos absolutely going bananas here,
Yeah,
just
well, I
screaming at the
mean,
reporters and this guy. Holy crap.
speaking of Santos, like, is this Congress, has this had the most indictments against current members of Congress like ever? I mean, that's a,
Well, what about Keating Five? I don't know.
yeah, I don't know the answer to that, but
Yeah, I
like
don't know the answer to that
between
either. But
Menendez and Santos, I mean, they're making a run for
and
the
like
cover.
the amazing thing for Santos is like he's the beneficiary of this narrow majority. Like sometimes we think of balance of power being like, oh, small groups can like sort of control the floor, right? Like we're seeing now with sort of the right wingers. But like also, like if the balance of power is this narrow, you're like protected from the party punishing you in like any sense. Like Santos would be so far gone if they had a 30-seat majority. Like you would have forgotten about him in January. And instead, he's like a crucial vote. And no matter what he does, they can't get rid of him. It's peculiar, man.
It is sort of insane that we're in this position. And I guess, I mean, one of the interesting things though is like, you know, you would think that even with narrow majorities like this, they would be able to do a little bit more than they're doing. I mean, this really is like a function of the party breaking down in like a really fundamental way. This it's historic because we're losing an organizational cartel, right? I mean, that's broken down. The procedural cartel that like controls the floor is broken down. Like everything that we've studied in congressional politics for the last 50 years is sort of breaking on the Republican side of the aisle, right? And it's not happening on the Democratic side of the aisle. I don't think it will. It could, but like really, it's Republicans are the party is breaking in front of our eyes, and it's gotten to the point where like now the mechanisms that you need in order for a majority to work are effectively dead right now.
And some really nasty precedents are being set here. The most important one, which I think is going on the radar, is like your candidate failing in the conference for the nomination speaker, and then just like being like, fuck it, party loyalty means nothing. And we're gonna oppose you until we go back to conference and try our candidate is a really dangerous precedent. And like that alone is a reason enough to bring down Jordan if I'm on the other side of things and just move on to other candidates who weren't involved in that. Because that's a really like The idea that party loyalty to the conference is basically out the window right now is really a new development. That's really sort of a massive acceleration of a trend. I don't know how you feel about this, but the big question looming behind this for me is how much of this sticks and how much disappears when we go back to someone who has a, you know, maybe not a huge majority, but a real majority in the House, right? When instead of having 10 seat majority, you have 25 seats, so you have a little more cushion. So it's like eight crazies can't control the floor. You know, a sub caucus of 20 could, right? Or 23 could, right? Like, do things continue to be where people are either going to be free agents against the leadership, or do we get back to, you know, true, you know, sort of like stable situation we had? I don't know the answer to that. I don't know what sort of like the lasting effects of this is going
to
be.
Yeah. I mean, you have to keep in mind, like, McCarthy was short like 20 something, 20 plus votes at first, right? It wasn't until he bought up like a significant chunk of them that it really made a lot of sense. And there are a couple of things that are really unusual about this. One, this group is not like a coherent group. They're not ideologically consistent. They're not asking for anything in particular. They're just sort of like against stuff, right? Generally speaking, you had the Roy contingent, which was against particular rules. You've got like the Gates and the Cranes and the Bob Goods and the others who are just sort of against things, generally speaking, but like there's no coherence to it. And the other part that's really weird about it is that it's on the wing, right? It's on the far right wing of the party. It's not in the, middle. And the question for me is like, you know, this becomes a real big problem, like a structural problem institutionally, not, well, I wouldn't say problem, but like structurally really interesting when that group that's against things is no longer the right wing, but the middle, right? Then you start talking about like some really substantive shifts in politics and organizational operations in the institution itself. Because if the middle breaks away, like it's a different Congress. Like it's just entirely different. And yeah, I think like one thing to keep in mind with like this organizational stuff and like the breakdown of like party loyalty and all this other stuff, like you got to keep in mind, like these conferences and these caucuses, they're voluntary. Right? They're voluntary. And for a long period of time, like how active or how assertive these conferences were, like depended on the members, right? For a long period of time in Congress, like the caucus is just the Democratic caucus, the Republican conference, they just did nothing, right? They weren't functionally organizing. They didn't have regular meetings. Like there was no like Tuesday meeting where like all the members gathered and talked. There wasn't like a whip meeting. Like those things didn't exist. And so like cooperation with the conference and with the caucus is voluntary. And on that side, like, you know, you're a member of Congress, you're kind of a free agent at the end of the day. But it is fascinating, like you said, that when you start breaking down that organizational part, you really are talking about the breakdown of party mechanisms entirely, right? And that means like the way that, you know, business has to get done in the House has to be different. And I guess at the end of the day, what we're looking at is this, whatever is going to happen with this majority, it's going to have to be a leader that's going to have to build some sort of like coalition government. And I don't know what that looks like, because it doesn't seem like any leader that Republicans are going to present is going to either one, admit to building a coalition, or two, like willingly go down that path, right? Without being like strapped to the hood of the car and like driven through a wall and then popping out the other side after a shutdown or something. If that analogy makes any sense.
I mean, I think, you know, one issue is how much the bonds of party mean to people. Because you can imagine the exact same members elected the exact same Congress, but they're split already into five different parties, right? And what the Republican Party actually is a coalition of, say, three groups or something, right? And there it's much easier sort of like just tear up the, you know, the agreement papers and go work with someone else. But it's like, how much further do you have to get beyond that point where we'd be better off working with the other party to actually go make that sort of deal in the center, right? Because that, you know, there's every chance that there's moderates in Congress right now on the Republican side who would be better off personally, policy-wise, and the whole thing if they were in a coalition with the Democrats and they were running the show. But the bonds of being sort of lifelong Republicans organizationally, financially, sort of like media-wise, and every other connection you have in D.C. is going to hold them to their party a lot longer than all these sort of other things would imply on paper.
Right.
And how much will they put up with being there? And people long for this sort of like, you know, Aaron Sorkin middle coalition. But even if it came to fruition, you know, it would be much more likely to be sort of just five or six members saying, screw it, I'm going to go become a Democrat. And like, what does it take to get them to that? I'm not sure right now. Right. A lot.
Right. And I think that's a really interesting point, because you notice that like all of these sort of like theatrics, all of the rebel animosity, if you want to call it that, is happening with the people who are most independent of the party, right? Yep. They don't rely on the party for fundraising. They don't rely on the party for resources. They don't rely on the party for campaigns, right? They are people who win their primary by being the most pure, right? Quote unquote, whatever that means, or the most conservative, quote unquote, whatever that means. And they're not relying on the party in the same way that like Don Bacon, Brian Fitzpatrick, and, you know, a lot of these other moderate Republicans are. And so like, yeah, like for the moderate Republicans to break away, it would be a titanic shift.
And they do break away, you know, in theory, right? You're making this up. It's like, that doesn't like help them like get out of like a tough seat. They're still gonna be frontliners on the other side, probably right. In a worse position than they were in some ways, right?
Yeah. And your so, primary like, just got way worse.
Right. And your primary got worse. And the general election is no swami. I mean, you're really, really putting yourself out on a limb to do something like that, which I think is why we see sort of, you know, we don't see that, but we also don't see sort of like the mythic coalition that so many people sort of have in their heads of like, oh, the whole center come together, right?
Right.
Where like, you know, 100 Republicans and 100 Democrats will form this new party in the center. But like that coalition comes together all the time. It's what passes the debt limit. It's what passes the appropriations bills a lot of times, but it has to be an unstable coalition given sort of the existence of a party system you're born into and live your life through, right?
Right. Yeah, I think that's a really good point because, like, again, at the end of the day, like, no matter who's speaker or speaker elect or whoever speaker pro tempore, no matter who it is, right, they're going to have to compromise with Democrats on these bills, right? The Democrats control the Senate, Democrats control the White House. Like, they're going to have to, your members aren't going to vote for these bills. So you're going to have to negotiate with Hakeem Jeffries and the Democrats in the House. And that's just a reality of governing and always sort of has been. And the thing that's really tough is that like the institution, the kind of electoral structures that support members don't align with the kind of like lawmaking realities in many respects. We're sort of built as a partisan and very parliamentary electoral structure, but like still require a lot of bipartisanship to pass legislation. It's a really weird dynamic in that respect.
Yeah. So let's shift gears and come back to sort of hardcore reality. Regardless of what you think of his policy positions, what do you think about Jim Jordan as a leader and capabilities for leading this conference, this Congress, negotiating with the president or the Senate?
I honestly don't know. We see this happen over and over where like the rebel gets the speakership, right? And this is not the first time. Like, first it was Newt Gingrich. He was the rebel who got the speakership. Then he was kicked out by John Boehner. John Boehner then got the speakership. And then John Boehner got kicked out. And, you know, Paul Ryan got the speakership. And I mean, it's just a sort of like constant iteration of like the next speaker who gets booted by, you know, a rebel caucus gets like comes up. And like one of the things that's really interesting, especially with Jim Jordan, is like now that he's in a leadership position, he's chair of the Judiciary Committee, he's changed tacks significantly, right? He's gone from that like hardcore right-wing leader that was, you know, in front of the Freedom Caucus, like the head of the Freedom Caucus for a period of time, really pushing like really partisan tactics, to a guy who falls in line behind McCarthy, right? And falls in line behind Scalise. And he's still there. Like he still does like the partisan things. He still has partisan hearings, but like he's changed directions because he understands that like he has a bigger role to play. And My sense is that once he gets there, like he'll still be himself and who he's always been. That's what his constituents expect of him. But as speaker, you've got a entirely different constituency you have to answer to. And I don't think that he can just kind of come in and be the House Freedom Caucus guy that he's always been effectively run the chamber, because he'll lose moderates on a regular basis. I mean, he'll lose people in his coalition that support him as speaker will be like, I am dying, right? And I need something to change before I completely go 6 feet under, so to speak.
How important is it for the speaker and the majority leader to have a good relationship in your view? Because I'm not sure that Scalise and Jordan.
Clearly not at all, right? we were just reflecting on this. I did not know Steve Scalise and Kevin McCarthy did not like each other as much as they did, right? I mean, Steve Scalise got elected by the conference to be the speaker nominee, and Kevin McCarthy's out there like, he's got too far to go. He doesn't have it. Like, he's like just talking about the whip count. It's like, it's an unbelievable like knife in the back. And, you know, Steve Scalise sort of did the same thing in some ways. Like, Kevin McCarthy might be trying to work a deal, and then, like, Steve Scalise would be like, well, maybe that's not – I don't know if that's a good deal. Doesn't sound like a good deal to my members, blah, blah, blah. And he's, like – he's kind of making overtures to the conservative wing of the conference. But, like, clearly you don't need that great of a relationship. I mean, like, Nancy Hoyer – Nancy Hoyer. The Pelosi-Hoyer relationship was, like, kind of tense, right? Though they were rivals in many respects. I don't know that they really have to work all that well together. I think it's best if they don't hate one another, but I don't know that it really needs to be all that, I guess, cooperative, for lack of a better. What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, part of me thinks that, like, in a party cartel model, you'd be better off if sort of like you elected a team that was pre-chosen as a team, right? And then they worked as a team. But that's not how we've ever really done it in either party, in Congress. And I tend to think it's okay even if they don't get along. I mean, they have enough incentive to work for the party that sort of their interpersonal relationship probably is not super important to the outcomes, right? You know, it's like if Hoyer and Pelosi work fine together, right? It doesn't matter if you like each other or not, right? So I don't know. I don't have any sense of Jim Jordan as speaker. I mean, we're now rotating through candidates, and I see on Twitter this grind of potential candidates, a lot of whom who have zero experience in the leadership, right? And maybe what they have is like they ran a committee or something, right?
Sometimes a lot of them not even that.
Yeah, exactly. Right? And I don't think like the Speaker of the House has to be like the greatest politician on earth, but having some experience has got to help. And throwing someone in there just because they can corral 217 votes one time in conference or on the floor is a dangerous game to play, rather than sort of building up people, getting them experience, and putting them inside sort of a system that promotes people from within. Now, we've had problems with that too on both sides, right? The Democrats had the Pelosi, Hoyer, Clyburn triumvirate on top that locked people out of the speakership and locked them out of like the development cycle. But you're just always in it on sure footing when you're bringing up people through the ranks of the leadership and letting them be involved in the whip operation and involved in sort of the leadership table and like know what they're getting into, right? Like, you know, people say like, I saw one Twitter thread that was like, what about like Mike Gallagher? And it's like, well, yeah, like I like Gallagher, but he's 39 years old. He's been in Congress for 8 years and he's never run anything except a select committee. It's like, maybe it'd be great, but you're rolling some big dice there.
Yeah. Right? Do you think that, I mean, well, one of the things that's interesting is that like now that Scalise is gone, I mean, you're almost guaranteed to get somebody. I guess Emmer is still in the mix.
Yep.
But like, you're almost guaranteed to get somebody who is less experienced than like the party leadership background. Do you think that one, Jordan will get picked, or two, is there a chance that like a third, fourth, fifth candidate has a shot at this in any outside reality? Like, do you see one of these candidates that,
I mean,
like,
people are discussing? I don't know what the alternative is. I think there's every chance. I think there's every chance Jordan fails on the floor, and maybe not even out of rational. I mean, one thing that someone said to me yesterday, I can't remember who it was, you know, like you get to a point sometimes in these things where people are no longer sort of acting rationally. And other things start to creep in, like vengeance and resentment. And, you know, if the Scalise people just resent Jordan and say, no, screw it, I don't want Jordan, right? And for no other reason, they resent him, right? You got to end up with someone. Like, someone else has to be speaker eventually. Like, I thought we'd be at McHenry faster than this, honestly.
McHenry is a speaker pro tem, or McHenry as
let's get things moving. And I don't know, that dam is going to break at some point, and maybe it's next week, but you know, we're like all of, you know, Tuesday was when McCarthy was removed. So we had, you know, 4 days last week, and now we have 5 days this week, and we're no closer in some sense. And if Jordan fails, we're really no closer. Right. Because now you have knocked out the top three, the top two leaders in the leadership and sort of the main coalescing opposition person to the leadership. And so you're really back at square one. And so I think it sounds like they're going to keep testing people. I mean, you read Mike Collins, Representative Collins, sort of like Twitter feed. He's just making unbelievable jokes about this, right? He's like, let me know if they get to me for nominations before Thanksgiving. I got to make Thanksgiving plans. Let me know if they're going to vote on me. And I get it, right? But there's people saying things like, you know, in some ways there's more incentive to get in after Jordan goes because someone is going to benefit from exhaustion eventually, right? And it probably, like, in theory or in some sort of normative desirability scale, should be someone like McHenry as a temporary. But, like, we're beyond sort of the logic phase here. And you could get to the point where, like, you're just not objectionable to people. And that's good enough.
Right.
Right? Like, their job is to, like, I don't hate this guy. Yeah. And so we got to be done with this. And you see this happen in political situations, you know, be it like PTA meetings or Congress, right? Where just eventually the air just comes out of the shit. And people are like, whatever, I need to make a decision, right? Who was it? Somebody. Ogles maybe said, you know, let's just lock ourselves in a room and not leave till it's done. That's sort of like the way to force the exhaustion. Right. You know, that wasn't going to happen. But like the exhaustion can come eventually, just people just fed up, right? And they just want to be done with it. And also actual sort of pressure, like the, you know, the CR is waiting in the wings. We could do another week of this. And, you know, the Israel aid's waiting in the wings that the administration's going to ask for, or maybe already has asked for, right? And can make a decision at some point.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not... It's frozen now, but that doesn't mean there aren't things. It reminds me of like a shutdown, right? Like when you have a shutdown, it seems like everything's frozen, but actually pressure is building in the system as paychecks don't go out and then another paycheck doesn't go out. And this feels like the same thing, right? I just thought the pressure would be built more by the end of, you know, the second week of this, but it hasn't yet.
I mean, I guess I could see a McHenry situation. I think that's probably, at least for me, that's maybe the most likely, right? Where they just say like, you know what, like, God bless Kevin Hearn, but he's not going to lead the conference, you know, sort of thing. Or, you know, some of these other candidates that pop up and they just get to a point where you're starting to pick like, you know, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh choice. And like, nobody's really coalescing behind anybody. Cause like, again, as we spoke, like the negotiations sort of like aren't happening or being conducive to winnowing candidates. They just seem to be adding more and getting rid of some. There doesn't seem to be like a process of like building up votes. It's just sort of like eliminating possibilities.
Well, we've laid bare one really important structural problem this week. And that is, everyone's always known that the conference vote is majority vote and the floor is majority of the House, which means almost the full conference, right? And it's always been wallpapered over by party loyalty, right? Or threats of discipline. And that's completely broken down. And so now these conference votes are almost like meaningless test votes in some ways, right? No one is abiding by them and no one's even pretending you have to abide by them. And so part of me thinks, if you want to get this done, then let me just get on the floor. Right. It's just get on the floor and fight it out there where we don't have the charade of nominating people to get votes that don't even matter. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that makes a lot of sense, especially when like the organizational, like the component of the conference of like, hey, we're going to have a nominee and then go to the floor. Well, it doesn't matter. Like, what's the point? Right. Why not just do this live? You know, just go down there, start saying some names and see what pops up and then do it again. Then do it again. I mean, Democrats would not be thrilled with that idea of like sitting on the floor, having to go through these votes anymore. But still, I mean, like that seems more logical in terms of a selection process currently as it stands than the one that they're currently going through where they're, you know, we're going to test people out in the conference and then move forward. So do you think we get to a point where the acting speaker pro tem just becomes an elected speaker pro tem? And we just move from there.
You mean formally or just like sort of through precedent?
Formally, like something? Just through, well, you know, yeah, I guess either. What
either,
like,
I don't know. I mean, I think that, I don't know. You know, in the beginning you had McGovern and the Democrats sort of like, he's not allowed to do anything. And that's because they were annoyed about the hideaway replacements, you know, under the Rule 1 Clause 3 authority that the speaker would have, but McHenry may not. And I think that was sort of what set the tone for nobody wants him to have any power. But I think, come the end of next week, I'm not sure the Democrats won't be turned around on that and will be more than happy to just accept him as powerful. And in that case, maybe he gets there. I've always thought the way out of this is it's most sensible for the Republicans, at least since the beginning of this week, is elect them Speaker Pro Tem through the CR. Like, who the hell wants to be Speaker right now anyway, right? And if you elect him through the CR, make McHenry eat the Ukraine aid deal, however that comes down with the Israel aid and the border security and everything else. Make him eat that deal and make him eat another CR and just clear the decks, or like Boehner would say, clear the barn, clean the barn. If I'm Jim Jordan, if I'm Tom Emmer, if I'm Steve Scalise, if I'm Austin Scott or Mike Gallagher, whoever the hell you want to throw up there, I would way rather start as speaker on December 1st with the Ukraine aid behind me and the omnibus done. Now, that's probably fantasy land, but some of it can be done by then, and at least the CR can be done by then, right? Or the Ukraine aid or something. I don't know, man. Who the hell? I mean, I don't know. What's the chances the speakership gets vacated again? Like, it's not zero.
Yeah.
It's not zero.
I mean, I think this is one of the things that's like, it's really tricky. Because on the one hand, he, like McHenry, needs to sort of navigate in a way that ensures he has a majority backing him. So he can't just like kind of go rogue, even though he is not an elected speaker. Like, he theoretically like is rogue, right? He could be rogue, but he's only as powerful as the majority will allow him to be. And I think like there are some obvious things that should just be done. If you are a Republican, if you are a Democrat, like just keeping like a CR, just getting that done, like Ukraine aid, there are enough people that want to do that. And McHenry could eat some of those things if he works with Democrats. But then like, I could see him being vacated at some point easily. I mean, like we're going to vacate the Speaker pro tem, right? And just like, this is insane. He's not like, you know, he's not elected by us. I could easily see that. And then we might be back in the same situation. The question is, do Democrats get involved in the same way, right? Do they decide to vacate McHenry?
I mean, just backing out of this one sec, I don't even have a good sense of who's calling the shots in the leadership right now. It's some combination
it seems like Kevin McCarthy kind of thinks he is, I think.
He's it's some combination of McCarthy, really McHenry, Scalise, Stefan. Like, there's people meeting who are making decisions about when to have conference,
right?
What to do on the floor each morning, when to go to the floor and make the adjournments, right? But, like, it's not obvious to me who it is. Right. And it's certainly not obvious to me what McCarthy's clout still is currently, right? And how much to the how much is McHenry like a real player at the leadership table, and how much is he just taking marching orders and not even part of the deal? I don't know.
Yeah, I know. The other part of this is like he is acting like in the way a speaker would, right? I mean, he did the thing with the hideaways. He took away Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer's hideaway down in the basement of the Capitol. Those are nice offices, right? It's nice to have an office in the Capitol, right? They're not super plush or anything, but it's nice to have an office down there. But then he's adjourning, he's recessing, subject to call the chair, which is himself, right? He's refusing to recognize people on the floor, which is like a longstanding time-honored tradition of like speakers. And he's not doing anything in a kind of positive way, but he's certainly setting up the fact that like, we will do nothing until I decide that it needs to be done, right? And that negative agenda power is like a lot of what a speaker is, right? And in exercising like discretion and recognition and saying like, oh, you seek the floor, but I'm just not going to listen to you. Like, that's within the speaker's power, but it's also like, it's a power move, right? Yeah. It's a flat out power move.
You know, it's not nothing that he is using that Rule 1 Clause 12A authority to recess at the call of chair, right? Like, right. He's not giving anyone a chance to get the floor right now. And that's totally within the rights of the speaker. Like, nothing's going on. Like, come into business. He can do that.
Yeah.
You know, they can even do that even more hardcore, and they could just recess overnight for days on end. And arguably could just snap in and snap out every third day and be constitutionally sound. So there's almost no way to pry the floor away from McHenry right now. That doesn't mean he doesn't respond to a majority coalition. That would figure out a way to fry him. But it's hard to see how an individual member could go down there and affect anything right now beyond objecting and making a point of order about his recess authority and sort of forcing that issue. We should wrap up here and get this thing pressed and out, because we were punchy and on point. Anything else you want to say?
I think that's it. I mean, if anybody knows what's going to happen in the next week, I think they're lying to you.
I agree with that. Yeah. I think there's guesses, and I could see Jordan not even making it to the floor the way Scalise didn't make it. I could see Jordan saying, I'm going to the floor, I don't care, bring me down there, and daring them to. I could see them blinking. I could see them bringing them down. I could see it all. This was awesome. I'm glad we did this.
This has been Congress Two Beers In. Everybody have a good weekend.
Yeah, we'll see you.